Securing your agency's data is paramount. IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, offers a tailored solution for federal agencies. Protecting sensitive data isn't just about safeguarding. It's about ensuring availability, recovery, and reliability to support mission-critical operations. As an IBM Platinum partner, 4Inc trusts IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, for unmatched speed and efficiency in securing, accessing, and ensuring the integrity of vital data. Visit FOURINC.com.
District the hell out of me.
This manager at a startup will say, look, we are priced at 2x GMV run rate. So for every dollar that we bring in GMV this month, it's 12 times for the run rate, then another 2x for valuation. So each dollar that we bring is worth $24. So we can spend $23 to get it. I was like, fuck!
My guest today is Rodrigo Bayer, co-founder and general partner at Upload Ventures. I met Rodrigo a year ago during a trip to Brazil and was impressed by his knowledge of the history of the Brazilian technology market and the trends of where it is going.
But in 2010, together with two friends, we co-founded Warehouse, which was the second venture firm in Brazil. And there was basically no deal to be done.
Rodrigo began investing in Brazilian startups in 2010. Then went on to become a managing director for Redpoint Ventures and a partner at SoftBank's early stage fund for Latin America. In the process, he invested in over 6 unicorns, including the likes of iFood, Rappi, Gympass, and Pismo. Today, we talked about the history and trends of the Brazilian venture ecosystem, the lessons Rodrigo has learned from investing in multiple unicorns, why he decided to start his own fund, and his approach to helping startups. This conversation was truly a masterclass on the Brazilian startup ecosystem, so I hope you enjoy my conversation with Rodrigo Bayer of Upload Ventures. Hi, Rodrigo. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Happy to have you here. Let's start with a bit of history on Brazil and how it connects to the work you've been doing as an early stage investor. You've been doing this for, I guess, almost 2 decades now. If you were like to draw a timeline of the Brazilian startup ecosystem over the last couple decades in a slide, what would be those important waves or stages? And I guess, how has your investment approach evolved through these periods?
We did have a very quick, small wave back in 99, 98, which fell apart when the bubble burst. But those are companies that are, some of them are still around. After that, 2001, 2, 3, 4, there was basically nothing. There was very little being done in the startup world in Latam. When I got back from the US in 2007, there was one fund in an American type of investment profile, which was Monashis. They had $10 million under management. Eric's definitely one of those true believers that started very early on.
The OGs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is the OG. Him and Kolk and Anderson, I think those guys, if I've been here for a long time, they've been longer. But in 2010, together with two friends, we co-founded Warehouse, which was the second venture firm in Brazil. If you look up to 2010, and Eric will tell you the same, there was basically no deal to be done. Very few deals here and there. But when you get to 2010, 2011, then you have Redpoint that raises $130 million in 2012. You have Kazakh and Monashis all raise $100 million roughly around the same time. So to me, that's really the start of what we're living today, is that space between 11 and 12. Because for the first time, you had funds that were sizable enough. And this is important. Venture fund needs to be $100 million to be a Series A fund, so he can get enough diversification and fund the companies enough that they can grow to be material. At that point, we had 3 funds over $100 million, Kazakh, Monashis, and Redpoint, and that kicked off the ecosystem. At the same time, you had Rocket Internet on a copycat strategy, which brought a lot of people very qualified from the McKinsey and BCGs of the world to the startup world. So they did a great service to the ecosystem. But the founders that we saw during those years, up to 2014, basically, were typically business founders. So a guy that worked a few years at McKinsey, went to do his MBA, and saw a cool B2C opportunity, and said, let's go back and replicate it in Brazil and do whatever not come for Brazil. That was the big thing to be done around those years. So not technical founders, mostly going after B2C opportunities. What happened was that those guys actually showed local entrepreneurs that one, venture capital is a viable way of growing your business. You can grow much faster, and made the financing track popular, because up to then, the founders would just bootstrap things or get very little investment. And then the second wave, we start to see things that are fairly unique, that are different from what's being done out there. That's when you get guys like Pipefy, like Gympass, like Olist being created. All of those, there wasn't a reference category for them. They weren't copying whatever does come for Brazil. But those are founders that learned the VC track and saw different opportunities and decided to build something different, which is...
From a timeline perspective, this is around 2015, 2016, I remind?
Yeah, I think Olist is 2015, Pipefy is 2015, Gympass a little bit earlier than that, I think 2012, 2013. But they start to get scale and they start to make waves in that window. And then you start to get a third wave, what happens around 17, 18, 19, which is, again, different. Those are much more experienced founders that were in the industry doing something for a very long time and say, I'm now going to solve that industrial problem using venture capital around it. And that's where you get the Bizmos of the world. Bizmos is a 2016, 2017 company. It's a different profile. It's a founder that really knows the industry that they're playing in. Maybe they don't speak as great of an English because they didn't do their MBA, but it's a different type of person. And now we're going at another big inflection point, which is second-time founders. Now we have gone long enough in the first cycle that those companies have exited, that people have learned how to scale. And now for the first time, you see founders in a reasonable amount that have learned how to scale a startup. And this is materially different. So very excited about what's been happening in the last few years, especially in Brazil. I think Mexico is further behind in that cycle. Mexico started off 2016, 17. So you're earlier in the cycle, Mexico. But for everybody else, Brazil is a little bit more advanced in the curve.
You mentioned how Brazil is a few years ahead of Mexico, and it's probably even more than the rest of the countries in Latin America. So aside its obvious size as a country, like, are there any unique attributes that Brazil possesses that are still absent in other Latin American countries?
No, honestly, I think the economy is a little bit less concentrated than Mexico, and that plays a big role. Right. Mexico, you do have a lot of the economy around the families, and that's very important. And in Brazil, it's naturally more fragmented, and you have people that have made it. And this notion of a role model, of an example, people that have been successful and built their own fortunes really triggers the imagination of people. So I think there is that component, which is a little bit cultural, but which the next generation in Mexico will have references. But I think the biggest chunk here was when people were looking, let's allocate to Latin America, Brazil is half of the GDP, it's big. It was taken off from the crisis into 2012. Everything was going to be great. And then you raised three funds of $100 million. And once those funds are raised, they're going to get deployed. And that really changes. Mexico, I think, first $100 million fund is in 2018. And before $100 million, you're either underfunding the companies or you're having a smaller than necessary portfolio, which drives you to be more conservative on the bets you do, which means that they don't grow as aggressive.
So interesting. And speaking of how the fund of the size is key for being able to kickstart the ecosystem, when you think about these phases of the Brazil, I mean, founders or kind of type of startup that you were seeing, can you map that to the type of investors and VC that they need? Does that actually reflect? Like, is there a change either in the composition of the team, the thesis from the firms that actually need to evolve to be able to support these, I guess, new waves of startups coming out?
I think it brings a lot more diversity on the investor side. At first, those funds were very, very similar. They started to veer off as you have supply side. If you look at initial portfolio of Kazakh, Monashis, and Redpoint, the overlap was huge. And that's because there was a shortage of supply. Once you start to get more differentiated supply, now you have funds that are specialized in SaaS. You have funds that are specialized in AI. You have funds that are specialized on the pre-seed of SaaS companies. So you build space, and venture is a very reinforcing cycle. You're successful, then the founders want to work with you, which means you can pick the best founders, which means you're more successful. So the only way for a new fund to come in and break that cycle and say, look, I also want to work with those successful founders, is for you to specialize and come up with a very specific niche pitch so that for those segments of founders, you're the very best pick. That's a little bit of the dynamic, and that's why we see this fragmentation and this specialization on the different funds. But I think it's more across funds than within the fund. If you look at the structure of Kazakh and Monash, it's relatively similar to what it was, but now you have competitors that are more specialized and have different approaches.
That makes a lot of sense. U.S. investors tend to talk about Latin America as LATAM and all of this whole homogeneous region. But really, when you unpack the layers and double click, as we have described, at least for the case of Brazil and Mexico, each country has its own characteristics, nuances. So there's some heterogeneity.
And that's like probably the biggest divide is Brazil and the rest of Latin.
Yeah.
If you look at the companies that have been successful in both markets, there are very few and far apart.
Yeah.
It's Meli, it's a new bank trying now.
Yeah.
But There are not even a handful of them. So those are very different markets.
I totally agree. So how should we appropriately think about Brazil as a market? Like, when you talk about with foreign investors, is there any lens that you use or framework to try to, I guess, explain them the market?
Brazil's different, one, in the way the economy is structured, and how do you actually get us access to it? If I think of Colombia, Mexico, Chile, those are very concentrated in very few families, and you need to have that access to actually crack into that market. Brazil, a little bit more fragmented. If you do have the lever of having access in Mexico, that can get you a very long way. In Brazil, you can have the biggest family supporting you. It will get you somewhere, but if somebody's executing better, they will take over. So that's one. I think there is a big push that most people don't see about Brazil towards a liberalization of the economy. If you look at the last 20 years, governments to the left, doesn't really matter. We have consistently shifted to a more liberal economy. We don't see as much movement in the other countries. And some of them, we even see them moving backwards, which is harmful to the ecosystem. Other thing that's different, American investors are much more used to Mexico, right? They went to
Cancun,
spring break in Cancun,
and Cabo.
They go for vacation in Cabo. But there is a sense of familiarity, and you have a lot more Mexicans in the U.S. You have Mexicans on the U.S. teams, which brings a sense of comfort in Mexico that most investors don't have with Brazil. And also, Mexico is 6 hours away from any city in the U.S. Brazil is 17 from California. So we see the U.S. investors much more present in Mexico than in Brazil, which also impacts the ecosystem because local funds don't compete as hard with the U.S. funds in Brazil for the early stages. And when it's a $30 million check, the guy will take on the flight. In Mexico, you see U.S. funds doing seed, Series A fund investments, which creates a problem. First, they don't really have the context of the country, which impairs the assessment. But more importantly, if you're writing a $5 million seed check in California, guess what you're going to do in Mexico? You're going to write a $5 million seed check. But the costs are a fifth of what they are in the U.S., our developers don't cost $300,000. So you overfund these companies, and that builds a bad culture. That builds a culture of excess of way too many people. And then again, the difference to Brazil. Brazil, we started in 2012. We had a crisis in 2014, another in 2016, and another one in 2019. The Brazilian, more experienced founders, and not talking about the guys that came in the last 3 or 4 years, they've lived through capital scarcity. And they know how to be disciplined. They know how to have the metrics. In Mexico, as you started in 2018, it has been up to the with a lot of capital. So the culture of burn is much more aggressive. And that's reinforced also by the excess of capital that comes from the U.S. So it's different markets. And thinking about them as one is a mistake. From the consumer perspective, it's different. From the go-to-market perspective, it's very different. And also from the funding landscape.
Let's double-click a bit, I guess, at least on the B2C and B2B, from a very bird's eye view. Because I remember a few weeks ago, I was discussing with the guys at NXTP, and we were discussing about why hasn't that happened as well in Mexico. And they were asking me, like, based on my experience talking to corporates and families there. So I guess, how would you characterize the adoption of software in general technologies within Brazil? I mean, SMB and large companies.
So I would say Brazil is more advanced in that curve than Mexico. But I think it's also a supply side issue. Right. We don't have many founders in Mexico going in after B2B plays. Or the ones that did exist, they were all going after the B2B marketplace play, which has a negative gross margin, which is a play that you can only fund in a market of excess capital.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit of a supply side issue there, but you have the phenomenon, which is for those that are not from Mexico, it's a cultural phenomenon where people go to the bank and they withdraw their money the day that they get it. There is this distrust about some technologies, some institutions that keep things very offline still in Mexico. But if you look at Chile, it's completely opposite. Chilean founders are mostly B2B because they had to bootstrap. And guess what? You can't really scale a B2C business with bootstrapping. So they went to the B2B side. So I think each market breeds a different type of founder. And also, we are just in the beginning of the story in Mexico. We have seen years of up to the... Now we have a big correction. And I think that's going to splurge much more experienced entrepreneurs that will do other things other than whatever.com for Mexico.
Speaking of the excess market that we had in 2020 and 2021... In December 2021, during a podcast interview, you said in reference to this topic, something that I thought was very interesting and took note of, which is if the market is not irrational as it is today and things go back as it was before, then you're in deep shit. And I think it's funny how market cycles are events that one might not fully understand or at least believe in until you experience them firsthand. So I guess what are your reflections on those years? What were some notable excesses? And what are lessons that you think we should keep top of mind?
I think that, again, a lot of the VCs in the world, this is especially true in Latam, but in the world, have only seen markets going up to the right. Yep. If you're a VC and you started your career after 2008, the market only got better every single year. So you don't know what a bad year is. And that's 14 years in a row. So people forget that interest rates are not zero, are not negative in a normal situation. I heard this once and this freaked the hell out of me. This growth manager at a startup was saying, look, we are priced at 2x GMV run rate. So for every dollar that we bring in GMV this month, it's 12 times for the run rate, then another 2x for valuation. So each dollar that we bring is worth $24. So we can spend $23 to get it. I was like, fuck. But that's the type of craziness that we got. And it just doesn't make sense. Like, this business need to be business at the end of the day. They need to make money. Of course, we can invest and support them during the growth stages, but at some point they will need to make money. And it's not only a business of raising capital. You need to build the real business. And people forgot that. And if you think about the VC incentive, it's very easy to forget. And this is a joke that I always have with the younger VCs. Like, if you want to look smart in the short term, all you have to do is invest in a founder that pitches well. Because you're going to invest now, he's going to go 6 months from now, and he's going to raise again, and you're going to mark up your portfolio 3x, you look really smart. The real test of is this smart is going to come 7 years down the pipe. But for 4 or 5 years, you look super smart because nobody's looking at the business. It's just looking if they can raise. And there was a lot of that. A lot of people were investing in thesis that don't work in Brazil or don't work in Mexico. But that's what the U.S. funds wanted to invest in. So guess what? I'm going to do a seed stage in this company, although I know that this business doesn't work in LATAM for whatever reason. But this U.S. fund wants to fund. I'm going to put it at 10 million. He puts at 50. I'm going to cut my fund 5x. Like, yeah, you look real smart in the short term. So I also started to see a lot of that. Fast forward to now, people are back to basics. A lot of people have left the VC world because it's not as exciting. It's not as hyped as it is. A lot of people left the entrepreneurial world. Now we're back to doing what we need to do as an industry, which is building business that will change the world in the future and become highly profitable.
There's two, I guess, trends or circumstances that I would love to get your take on, which is on one side, particularly in Brazil, you have this, as you mentioned before, this wave of second-time founders, which is relatively new, given that, I mean, you're just completing one cycle of founders having raised money, I mean, 2010, 11, 12, and now coming out after having successful exits. And on the other, you have, like, as we were discussing, I mean, these learnings that we shouldn't raise probably, I know that the $5 million seed round or pre-seed round in Latin America is not the same as the U.S. Right? But now you have these second-time founders that are, given that background, they're also able to access U.S. markets from funding. I'm curious, like, what, because you might be seeing those kind of, still today, those rounds where you have a second-time founder, very successful person, being able to raise, I know, $3, $4, $5 million on a PowerPoint in Latin America. So I guess, how do you think about those rounds?
I think they're going to be more the exception than the rule, especially because also the U.S. funds retrenched. The reason why they were coming to LATAM is because California was hyper-competitive. California is not hyper-competitive anymore. Maybe for AI, but for anything else. So there is a retrenchment. Of course, the relationships they built, they will still write a few checks, but those are few and far apart. We are not seeing, especially in Brazil, we're not seeing the U.S. funds doing early stage here, doing the pre-seed series in Series A. They are coming in at the Series B, and that's a different conversation because also Series B funds in the U.S. write $30 million checks. But the Series A funds in the U.S., they write 10 to 15 or 8 to 15. In Brazil, Series A is writing 2 to 5. So now we have this gap from 5 to 30 because there is no Series B, local Series B, that we need to bridge. There is this gap, this $10, $15 million check in the middle that somebody will need to pick up the tab. And there is enough fund. Well, there aren't many funds there. Marcelo's building Bicycle, you start to see that. But there are not many Series B and C funds with a ticket for LATAM.
Still, I mean, as you say, those are the exceptions, but I mean, you get the chance to see a lot of those exceptions just because you started very early in this market. And in the end, like, you know, VC is about like finding outliers. And obviously when you have a second-time founder, you listen, or at least you take the pitch meeting. So I guess like, so how do you think about those, as you say, exception rounds where you had like very successful founders raising what you thought was a lot of money 1 or 2 years ago, still in this, not but now in this market?
So we just backed a guy that built a unicorn and sold it. And the guy was like, I need 2.5 million. It's not 5, it's 2.5 million. Why? Because if I take more money, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to spend it. It's just natural. And then you create horrible culture. If people don't look at it, a seed stage company in the US, maybe 6 to 20 people. We had seed stage companies in Brazil with 115. you're creating a management complexity that doesn't need to be there that early. You need to build a product. Why do you need 115 people to build a product? It's not a rocket. It's a software product. Having more money will build bigger organizations, which will bring problems that you don't need to deal with this early. If you have 20 people, you don't need managers. If you have 115, you need directors, managers, coordinators. So you start to jump into problems that you don't belong to you yet. Why are you bringing that forward on top of the problem that you have to solve, which is finding a product that works? I think more experienced founders understand that game. And they say, look, I need what I need. There will always be the guy that wants more money just because it makes his ego better on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. But honestly, I'm happy to lose that one. If the reason is because he wants his ego, I'm happy to lose that deal.
After almost 20 years investing in VC, two interrupted attempts to build your own VC firm, you finally had the chance to do it with Upload. I think the irony is that you did it probably in the worst moment to start your own fund and fundraise on your own. So I guess what is different this time, and also how different is running a fund as a managing director or partner versus actually founding a firm yourself?
So I think what's different is that I was ready. It took me 10 years to learn the business. When I started Warehouse, we invested first check into iFood. We own 30% of the company. And we couldn't keep the organization together to profit out of it. And that bothered me. We did an early exit in iFood because we decided that the firm wouldn't continue in the future. And that bothered me. So I took a year to try to figure out how do you build a firm. When I left, that's what was in my mind. It's like, I can't make that mistake again. And then I went to Redpoint. And the reason why I joined Redpoint is because Jeff and Matthias. Jeff's the founding partner at Redpoint, and Matthias, the founding partner at eVentures. They all had been doing venture for 20 years. And I said, look, I'm going to spend 4 or 5 years there, going to learn, not make the same mistakes. And there are a bunch of things about managing the VC business, which go way beyond investing. You have to think about your LP base. You have to think about how you build a portfolio. How do you create the story of success so you can raise fund two? You're normally not a viable firm with fund one. So how do you create early successes so you can create a fund two? There is a bunch of complexity on how you manage the VC business that's normally not transparent. And the only thing I knew is that I didn't know that. And I learned over my time at Redpoint, and that was super important to me. If Redpoint had continued, I would probably be there. I loved the team. I loved the firm. I loved what we had built. When I saw that it wasn't going to continue, and I saw that I was ready to build my own thing, decided to jump ship and build what became Upload. It was not about market timing. The founders that are inevitable, they are out raising in this environment, and they will still raise, they will still thrive. Hopefully, I'm one of those. I'm inevitable in the VC business.
You briefly mentioned how you have to think about raising Fund 2 and creating some early successes in Fund 1. So I guess as you were describing, as you become more of a fund manager, which has a lot of differences between being purely an investor, how does that affect, I guess, your way of investing or your approach, if it does at any level?
I do less investing than I would love. If I could, I would just invest. And now we have to manage the team. We have to think about the firm strategy. You need to fundraise. There is a bunch of other things that if I had my way, I wouldn't do it. What I like to do is invest and support the companies. That's what gets me out of bed every day. To an extent, I'm an entrepreneur. It's a different type of business to be an entrepreneur in, but you're going to have to clean up the table and carry the coffee back to the room and
make payroll.
Yeah, you do whatever it takes. It is different. I don't think it changes as much my investment side. What it does change is my allocation of time. Now I have to do a lot more things that I'm not as excited about. But then it's great because I have partners, some of them which do a lot of that and help and are much better at it than I am. We've built a team that each one of us takes a bit of the load, and then I get a slightly bigger share of doing what I like.
I'd love to double click on this idea of creating the early successes on fund one. How do you actually do that? Like, how does that, is that a strategy? Is that the specific tactics? How does that translate into your thinking when investing?
For example, if you build a portfolio of all pre-seed companies, what's going to happen with the pre-seed companies that they're going to take a year to eventually raise a round. And given that the amount of capital that you put in into a pre-seed company is super small, it doesn't move the mark on the fund. If I do 3x over $1 million in a $110 million fund, doesn't move the needle. So by the time you're closing your investment cycle, the first 2-3 years, first year, your failure rate, people that will die within that time frame. So you're going to have your markups are not going to be huge or big enough to move the mark on the fund early. And those companies are not yet perceived as successes. They may be tracking well, but still, it's very early to tell. It's a company that's in the seed stage or in the Series A stage. One thing that we did, for example, we did do a few investments on the later end of a Series A, because those companies, from being a Series A and then being perceived as a success on the Series B, it's a much shorter time frame. Of course, I have a pre-seed deal that won't be marked up or might not be alive by the next time, but those bigger checks in bigger companies do move the fund faster early on. That's a couple of the things to think about. And then you really have to work on making sure that there's external validation of the companies you're doing. So getting other people to lead the next round, probably reference investors, the better. At a significant premium, even better. But I did this pre-seed, the seed. Yeah, I got to 30%, but there's no external validation. LPs are going to look at it like, either you're a genius or you're funding a company that you shouldn't be funding. Both scenarios are not good because LP won't know, so he won't commit. And he'll say, just wait until you prove out that one. Those are the things that I think about. It wouldn't cross my mind before I went out and learned a little bit how LPs look at it and understood and learned a bit at Redpoint on how to think about this.
It's super, super interesting. And yeah, it's definitely another layer of complexity to just invest in. The last time I saw you had invested in 6 unicorns, correct me if the number's higher now, but are there any common patterns in these investments? I mean, checking on the names, I know significant part of those are B2C. I wonder, like, any patterns, if you do some kind of reflection on those investments and you think like, okay, there's these common patterns. And also, if you do that pattern matching, does you think it's helpful or actually harmful to your decision-making process?
One thing that strikes me is how much these founders actually knew the problems that they were solving. If you take the guys from iFood, they were running a company called DiskyCook, which was order taking through the phone. They did that for a few years. Well, Patrick did that for like 10 years. And then Eduardo, Felipe, and Toca did that for a couple of years until they saw the online pickup. And then they said, look, do you want to fund this company? I was like, no, I don't want to fund a call center with delivery guys, but I want to fund the digital part of it. Then we spun it off. So founders that really knew. If you take Thiago from Olist, the guy had been a merchant. Then he had created a network of stores. Then he had created a distribution channel through Walmart. Then he decided to take it online. That didn't work. And then he decided to become an enabler for merchants. So those are guys that really understand the pain that they are trying to solve. Alessio from Bitefire. He built a company first called Acesso Zero. And they had a lot of manual processes, which they controlled on Excel. He said, I don't want to do that. I want to create a workflow that it's simple enough for the business user to create and manage the workflow. He built Bitefire. Ricardo from Pismo, they built Conductor, which is now called Docky, They sold that company. They waited a few years, I think 5 or 6 years, and came back and said, are we going to build a similar company with bleeding edge technology? It's like, yeah, I can buy that. The vast majority of them had very, very deep knowledge of the problem they are trying to solve. But that's also my bias. I've been a consultant, I've been an MBA. I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. I don't know the specifics of the market, but I know the analytics. So I try to bring the analytics to founders that really know the market that they are in. But that's my bias. I don't think it's reflective of all the unicorns out there.
Speaking of that bias, like, do you find yourself continuously looking for that in the new founders that pitch you? And thinking about how does that success influences your future decision making?
Yes, definitely. That's a core criteria for us, is how much the guy understands the market that he's in. The founder needs to know inside out the problems, the market, the players, the strategies. Can you talk to me about the strategy that your competitor is taking? Why is your better? Why is he making that decision versus you making the other decision? Why can't the incumbents compete with you? I like people that really, really understand. But again, my bias. A lot of founders that came out of MBA built enormous companies. It's just not the guys that I've had more success with.
Have you passed on companies that you shouldn't because of that bias?
Probably. Knowingly or unknowingly. I passed on a bunch of companies that, looking back, I was like, yeah, I should have done that. But it's not about the deals I don't do. It's about the deals I do, right? It's about building a portfolio of 25 companies that are going to have a significant number of successes in it. I don't suffer as much for, oh, I missed that one and that became a unicorn. Yeah, I don't want to be a monopolist on the unicorns in the country. It's like, that's just a stupid dream. What we want is to build a good portfolio with a significant number of successes and people that we like to work with. Because we do work with them for 10 years. If it's going to be painful for the next 10 years, I don't want to do it.
When you think on decisions that you regret from an investing perspective, like, what are usually those and the reasons behind those decisions?
I think the ones that really hurt me is when I fell for the selling skills of the founders. A founder needs to have selling skills. So another bias that I have, so one is knowing the market. The other bias that for me is super important is analytical people. People that know their numbers, that have the organization, that can show me a spreadsheet. And you know Katya from Maver, Sheen, right? She says, I'm going to deliver X percent of growth, and then she delivers X minus one or X plus two. That's it, right? That's the type of founder that I relate better. Because it speaks the same language that I do. And when we're looking at numbers, when we're looking at analytical problems, it's much easier to have a conversation. This is not working or this is working. It's not fuzzy. I like those guys better. I like to work with them better. For me, it's easier. I manage to have more impact in the company because I can weigh in and try to challenge them and provide a little bit of what I learned. And sometimes the guy's so great at pitching that clouds that. So those are stories that I regret.
Speaking of helping founders and Kate, who told me a bit how he has been working with you, I've heard you multiple times describe the role of an investor as a coach. Not all founders need the same help, or sometimes they don't all want to be helped to the same degree. So I guess, what have you learned about building trust with founders and laying the foundations for them to actually listen to you, and as you say in your website, to like become that first call whenever they need it?
We try to be available, and we try not to force into anything. We will offer. We'll say, look, if you're going to talk about people, I'm not the person. You go, we have Marty. If you're going to talk about how to structure a finance area, talk to Marco. Even within our team, we try to hand off to the person with most experience in it. But we offer. Some founders take it. Some founders don't want it. And sometimes they don't want it that moment. And then we provide value somewhere else. And the guy starts to build that relationship. we accept that some founders simply don't want it. Fine by me. But we try to, whenever they call, we try to get it done. Because that's what's going to make them call more often.
Kate Castillo, the founder of Neighbor, who we're referring to, told me that you never tell her what to do, but ask provocative questions to understand how she thinks and challenge her and like open her up to new alternatives or paths. What do you think are good questions for founders? And like, what are the type of questions that elicit the most reflection and help them see beyond where they are?
That's a good question. And it really depends on the founder. It depends on the personality. There are founders where we can have that like very broad conversations. I was having a conversation yesterday with Thiago from Olist, discussing on how to position the business. What are the key challenges? So that's a very broad conversation. There are founders that react much better to, did you look at this one? Did you look at this model? Why don't you go talk to this or that person that have solved this problem before and see if that works for you? What I don't want to do is run the company. If I'm going to run the company, if I'm going to make the decision, then I'm going to own 80% of the equity. Then I'm going to be the founder. So what we try to do, we benefit from looking at a lot of companies. I look up at 2,000 companies a year. We've seen a bunch of things that work, a bunch of things that don't work. And it's not because your company is failing that nothing works. Sometimes your onboarding works, your sales motion works, your marketing works. And what we try to do is I hear from the founder what the problem they're trying to solve. And I look at this Rolodex of references. Who has solved a similar problem? And say, look, go talk to them. They solved that. They've done something similar. Maybe in another industry, maybe in another area. If I can make them do new mistakes, it's great. Don't do a mistake that somebody has already done. If somebody has already made that mistake, let's learn from it and move on and try to figure out a new way to screw up or maybe get it. So it's questioning. It's questioning and it's a lot of references.
In that line, what would you say are the areas where investors kind of can most impact the trajectory of a company or founder and the areas where they actually can't, despite trying to?
I think different investors have very different profiles. For example, at Redpoint, Manuel, amazing guy in tech. He would sit down with the CTO, look at the roadmap, help the CTO think about how to hire, how to structure the organization, think about architecture. That's a conversation I can't have. I can help you think through sales, but better than I, you go talk to Farlan, our guy that helps startups do sales. I can help you think about a strategy. How are you going to position the company? What are the markets that it should be going after? What's working, what's not? A lot of a startup is deciding what's not working. Because if you say, this is not working, you have two options. Either stop doing it because it's not necessary, or if it's necessary, you're going to focus everything that you need and find a way to solve that. Not a lot of investors will tell you, this is not working. That's where I come in. It's like, whenever the team calls me into a meeting, it's like to give somebody a bad news. It's not working. And let's figure something out. Like, your conversion is not great. Your sales motion is not working. Your cash burn is too high. I'm the bearer of bad news. But be able to have that conversation and then looking at the numbers and making sure we agree that that's a problem helps the founders figure out what they're going to do. Either they're going to stop doing that or they're going to find a solution. But a lot of people postpone that conversation and keep doing it, things that are not working for too long.
So I guess, what have you learned? I don't know if you have a formula or a framework or about how to have those hard conversations and actually being able to, I mean, get that message across with your founders.
Well, I'll tell you how I do it. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But we try to, it's a value for us to be as upfront about it as possible, as explicit as possible. We see this, for us, this is not working because this and that. What do you think? That's how we have. And we've had very hard conversations like, this partnership's not working. You and two as co-founders are not working. How are you going to solve that? What's best for the company? And in doing that, you have to be genuine about trying to find a solution and what's the solution, the best solution. Putting the finger and saying, this is not working, and walking away and going to your happy hour at 6 a.m. in the afternoon also doesn't help the founder. So you have to be genuinely committed to help them figure out how to solve that, but being very upfront about what's working and what's not. And it's not an attack. It's not you that's screwing up. It's just not working. Let me try this. Not working. Are we going to try something else? Or what are we going to do? It doesn't need to be confrontational. We are in the same boat. I need you to be successful.
Tying this idea back to something we talked about before in terms of capital efficiency and, I mean, the funding environment we went through 2020 and 2021. How do you think about a startup's capital efficiency? And if you always think that more efficiency is better, like how do you advise your founders to think about that balance between profitability as well as, I guess, growth or risk-taking and trying new products, new business lines?
I think efficiency is always better. But efficiency to do what? And that's super important. There is a moment where you're going to be figuring out the problem. Having a CFO doesn't help you figure out the problem. Having a marketing team doesn't help you figure out the problem. Having a sales team doesn't really help you. So that's all inefficiency in the very early stage. You're trying to build a product. You need to sit in front of the client, hear about his pains, go out and code it, and come back and iterate on that. Then it's going to change. Then the next step is I need to build a machine. I need to build sales. Now that I have a product, I need to build sales. And it's how efficiently do you actually build that sales team? Sure, you can go out and hire 40 salespeople at once. Odds of this working out are nil, zero. Or you can hire 3 people, learn the pitch, learn the sales motion, learn the sales cycle, learn how to train people, and then you hire 10. Once you've done that, you hire 20. And I want you to go as fast as we can in an efficient manner. So I don't think it's a trade-off. If you've got the machine all oiled and performing very well, go as fast as possible. But building the machine, it's much easier if you do it in an efficient manner, because you're not adding noise to the equation. When you splurge and you do things too aggressively, you create so much noise that you don't know what's going on. So I think you need to be efficient in doing what you need to do. And people get carried away on doing way more than they have to do for each given stage.
Rodrigo, this has been an amazing conversation. I have one last closing question. What's something that's currently emerging that excites you? It can be anything, technology, an industry, a company.
I think we're at a very exciting stage in Brazil, and I think it's going to come to Mexico relatively soon. And this is important. For the first time ever, we have experienced teams. When I started this in 2010, you had no marketing manager to hire because nobody had to be a marketing manager of a startup. Now you have 40-something unicorns, each trained 4,000 or 5,000 people. You have 200,000 people that have been trained to scale startup. You can build amazingly qualified teams. Of course, it's going to be hard for you to keep the same bar at 1,000 people. But for the initial 20, the initial 30, you can have a very high bar on how qualified that team is, right? Which wasn't here before. And then enables 2 things. First, compete globally. 10 years ago, impossible to compete globally because you didn't have the funding, you didn't have the talent. Now you do have the talent, you do have the funding. And guess what? Guy that has done whatever.com for Brazil, he has 2 options now. Either he's going to do something that's not for profit to save the world, which is noble, or he wants to play the global game. I've done whatever.com for Brazil. So that change, I want to see more Pismos, right? I want to sell companies to Visa, not to the local small shop in a corner. And I think that's a big change that's happening people in Brazil are learning that they can go bigger and they can go global. There is this big question mark on how AI will play out, how much of that is going to be an application versus foundational models, and how much is it a SaaS play embedding AI, or is it a pure AI model? So there is a bunch of excitement and questions around this. And I think some great companies will come out of it massively deflationary for the economies, creating a lot of efficiencies, because in general, our economies in Latam are highly inefficient. So if we can leapfrog a couple of evolutions here and accelerate the efficiencies of the economies, will be huge businesses.
That's awesome. And it does sound exciting, I think, especially what you say regarding founders going global. I think it's becoming much more common. That's super, super, super exciting as a trend to see companies like built for all the world and not just for our own countries. Rodrigo, this was amazing. Thank you for the time.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great conversation. Thank you for that. Bye.
Securing your agency's data is paramount. IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, offers a tailored solution for federal agencies. Protecting sensitive data isn't just about safeguarding. It's about ensuring availability, recovery, and reliability to support mission-critical operations. As an IBM Platinum partner, 4 Inc. trusts IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, for unmatched speed and efficiency in securing, accessing, and ensuring the integrity of vital data. Visit FOURINC.com.